Well, this has been, I hope, a very interesting session for you. There's no question about pluralism continuing. And there's going to be a great deal of challenges in religious freedom that will be out there. But as we've looked at the trends and challenges and practices, you can see that of suggesting that the courts can solve the problems is problematic. The courts only have a role to play, and they'll play it as best they can, but they're governed by the law and the Constitution. That's what they're required to do. And I hope that this brought a bit of practicality to our discussions about what judges and lawyers can do in assisting, and so that we won't waste our time looking too much for a solution there, but we'll perhaps look other ways to solve society's problems. Now, we have approximately an hour left that you get to ask the judge the question. I suspect that there have been times, at least if you've been in court, that you wish you could ask the judge question instead of having him ask you the question. And we've decided that they should not wear robes today so that you wouldn't be hesitant. I should also point out that here in the United States, neither one of these judges have contempt power. And so you can ask any question you want. But remember that I have contempt power. So if I suggest that we should make questions a little shorter, it's with something in mind other than just winking at you or waving at you, I'll have the bailiff come in and sequester you. So this is your time to begin to ask questions. Please ask them to one or the other or both. And please, as best you can, make them questions. Not speeches, but questions. Now, we have microphones that we have to use. And my colleagues are very good at this sort of thing. Yes, we can start down here if we will, please. How many more microphones do we have? Just one. How fast are you?
Jorge Gentile, Argentina. Para el juez de Nueva Zelanda.
Just a minute, we've got to get you first. What are we on?
15.
15? Okay. 15. Got it. All right, they're ready now.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay.
So this is for the New Zealand judge. A while ago, New Zealand did not have a written constitution such as Israel or the United Kingdom. So what is the fundamental part of the constitution? Is there is it Laika? Is it does it cover all these islands? And in the case of Samoa, for example, American Samoa, it follows the American Constitution. If I am correct or not, could you explain that to us?
Yes, the question is the. What is the nature of the constitution in New Zealand, and how does it work in some of the Pacific Island nations? First of all, I should explain that although Australia and New Zealand are very closely interested in the Pacific Islands and provide economic support to a number of the nations in the Pacific, They are all, with one or two exceptions, independent nations, and so each has their own constitution. In the Pacific Islands, as distinct from New Zealand, there have been a number of different constitution models that have been used, and in one form or another, they do follow the international norms. Is that coming through? Oh. Can we fix that?
You have to repeat.
So I'll speak again. Is that coming through? Yeah? Good. Sorry, I'll just have to briefly repeat that. But just to explain at the outset that each of these nations, with one or two exceptions, have their own separate constitutions, separate from Australia, separate from New Zealand, separate in Samoa and Fiji and so on. By and large, those constitutions do introduce international norms from the international instruments, but they are all individually modelled to the particular nation. New Zealand has what we call an unwritten constitution, which I know horrifies people from the United States and other places. It sounds like anything goes, but it actually works very well. It's a constitution or form of constitution that's derived from the United Kingdom, the Westminster model of democratic government. And there is a combination of statute. We have a Constitution Act, but that covers only part of the field, like the appointment of judges and so on. From 1990, we've had a Bill of Rights Act, which incorporated all the usual human rights norms. And we also have a Human Rights Act. But the rest of the Constitution is made up from parliamentary convention, which again is an unwritten part of the law, but there are very clear conventions which govern the way Parliament operates, partly convention and partly under our Constitution Act. So the short answer is that in New Zealand we have a combination of sources of constitutional arrangements. But in the Pacific Islands, they have more comprehensive constitutions which are modelled to suit their own circumstances.
There's a question back there.
My question is to Justice Azmi. Well, I have one question. I would say two questions, if you allow me. First of all, you spoke of the situation in which a non-Muslim woman wishes to marry a Muslim man. And say, you said she needs to convert. And the opposite is not possible, meaning a Muslim wishes to marry a non-Muslim woman and decides to go through to his church. This is the first question. I saw your answer already. I would appreciate to have it with more detail. But anyway, as I was assuming that, my second question is the following. I'm not discussing, obviously, internal policies of your country. You'd not be polite. And out of other reasons, I'm not prepared for that. But from, I would say, a freedom of religion point of view, this impossibility of changing religion as a matter of personal decision, and the fact that you don't have a conflict court to rule when a non-Muslim and a Muslim want to decide matters of alimony or parental decisions, in which a non-Muslim will be obliged to accept jurisdiction of a Muslim court, do you think that these two points, in looking from a freedom of religion point of view, are considered positive or, I would say, not positive? Thank you.
Okay. The first question is, you're right there, in Malaysia, both parties must be Muslims before they can get married. If either of them is not a Muslim, then he or she must be converted to be a Muslim.
Not the opposite.
Not the opposite. So the second question is, because of this, you have two separate courts judging an instance that, as I said to you, there are instances where during marriage, one of the parties decided to convert to become a non-Muslim. Then the, who determines the validity of that divorce or whatever it is? According to our law, it is the Muslim court. Now, whether that is good or not, is could be, the Muslim will say that it's necessary. But if you look at it objectively, I totally agree with you that perhaps those issues should be decided by one court, irrespective of who the parties are. But as I said, this is historical. This was the law that was passed when we became independent, long before we became independent, and that is how our Muslim rulers wanted, and that is how all the parties agreed that when we became independent in 1957, the Chinese and the Indians and the Christians and the Muslims agreed to that provision, and that's why it's still there in the Constitution. What will happen in the future, I do not know. Thank you very much.
Okay. I would like to know from Mr. Azimi da Malaysia, if Malaysia recognized the rights of the human rights of the citizen and about the liberty of religion and beliefs, if you can see the perspective of changing, or if you at least see the possibility that we have harmony with the other religions in Malaysia, like proselyting, because you said that is not possible in the Muslim society. But you said that the rights of conscience. And so how is that going to work? Because in one side, the people can join the Muslim creed, but not the opposite. The other ones cannot adopt another religion from the Muslims.
I don't know whether I understand the translation is rather. On the question of human rights, I agree with you. You're talking about human rights as human rights, that you should have more freedom for people to do what they want and who they want to marry. I believe this is subject to correction. In Singapore, a Muslim and non-Muslim parties can have their marriage registered under civil law in Singapore, but that is not so in Malaysia. So this is the policy of the country. The policy of the country of Malaysia today is that when two Muslims want to get married, when two persons want to get married and one of them is a Muslim, then the other must also be a Muslim. That is our national policy, our policy of the country. As to whether it is against human rights, liberties, that is a different question altogether. You know, sometimes you cannot get the best of everything because the population, the Muslim population in Malaysia will not accept that. They will not accept a law to allow a Muslim and a non-Muslim to get married. That is how I understand. The Muslim population will not agree to that sort of laws. They will just turn down. You know? Yes?
Okay. My question is this. Suppose there's a nice Malaysian man who comes to the United States to go to school and meets a nice young American girl, and they fall in love, and he wants to marry her. They marry here, but he wants to go home with his family. What happens then? He goes there? Is it, I mean, what's the international law issue here?
If you apply conflict of law there, that marriage is determined by the lex celebrationis. That means it's determined by the law of U.S. When he goes back to Malaysia, he is a Muslim. Now, whether the Sharia court will recognize that marriage in U.S., I do not know why. But if you follow the civil law, the way I learned, the lex celebrationis is the law of America. And by that, the civil law of Malaysia will recognize that as marriage. But because one of them, he is a Muslim, then the problem will arise. I cannot understand. We have to decide when the case arises. But so far, we have not come across that case yet. Am I right on the laws?
I would like to invite both of our jurists, Judge Randerson and Judge Azmi, to comment on the concept of judicial independence. We strive in most Western jurisdictions to follow what we refer to as the rule of law. And what about the making of a decision that is very unpopular but nevertheless would follow the law as you see it? I'm somewhat familiar with the New Zealand situation because of its British underpinnings and traditions. But even there, the comment about going clear to the Privy Council on an appellate decision raises a question in my mind. I know that that has been done in other Commonwealth countries, but sometimes it's at least some that I'm aware of, it doesn't happen anymore. And part of my question is, how much influence over the courts in these two countries do legislative branches have?
Influence over the court?
In other words, if the court makes a decision that is politically unpopular, then is the legislative branch in a position to overturn that law or overturn that decision or change the Constitution?
The law allows them to pass a new law and say that decision was a wrong decision. That's just like any other country. If the legislators don't agree with the decision of the court, for that particular case, they can't do anything. That the ruling of the court will apply to that particular case. But of course, the legislators can change the law for the future cases. And I think Britain has done quite a couple of times. And Malaysia maybe, I can't remember whether there's any, but I must say this, that the Malaysian judiciary are not as active as the US judiciary, perhaps, or the Indian judiciary.
How fortunate.
We are more docile, we follow what the legislators want. My personal argument is, three or five of us in the highest court cannot override what 300 people in parliament voted by 27 million people have decided what the law should be.
Would that principle also apply to the constitution of Malaysia?
No. The constitution, yeah. We are bound by the constitution. If the law is ultra vires the constitution, then it is ultra vires the constitution. No judge will uphold a law that is ultra vires the constitution.
What if the court believes that it is not ultra vires? And the legislature disagrees, and you have a constitutional decision?
No, if the court thinks that it is not ultra vires, then the law stands. It's not, the parliament would not have passed that law unless it thinks it is not ultra vires. Okay, would you like to have I answered?
We sometimes wish we had those powers in New Zealand. But unfortunately, we operate a little differently. Just as in Malaysia, it's always open to Parliament to pass a law which the courts then must follow and apply. But unlike Malaysia, we don't have the power to strike down a statute as ultra vires or infringing the Constitution. We do have power under the Bill of Rights Act to declare that something is inconsistent with the Bill of Rights, but that is as far as our powers extend. We don't have the extent of power that Malaysia has. But just a very recent example, at the moment there are some prosecutions pending against a group of people in the country who are alleged to have been in possession of arms, weapons, unlawfully, for an unlawful purpose. And some are also alleged to form part of what in our legislation is described as a criminal group. The Supreme Court, which incidentally is above me, I'm not in the highest court of the land, but the second highest. But our Supreme Court...
Should be.
we'll have to tell the Attorney General. The Supreme Court has recently ruled that evidence the police obtained against these people by filming on private land is not admissible or cannot be used in evidence against this group of people, or certainly most of them. Parliament was very unhappy about that, and within a week introduced a bill to Parliament, and we have only a single house. We don't have a two-level system. Not to overrule the particular case, but to say that from now on, filming on private property is lawful if it's done under a warrant. And there's also a proposal to make that retrospective so that cases that are coming through the system, not the particular one that the Supreme Court's ruled on, but others, that there can be no means of challenging the legality of that evidence from filming in 40 or 50 other cases. Now, of course, all the lawyers in the country and all the constitutional people who are interested in the Constitution have been up in arms about all this, but essentially, if the government has the numbers, it can pass that legislation. It's fairly unusual for that to happen, but it can happen, and the courts are then to apply whatever is passed.
Next question.
Judge Zaki, you mentioned early on that the government is quite involved in trying to promote Islam, promote a more conservative Islam. And I note that many of my Malaysian friends talk about a Malaysia where women didn't wear the hijab, where women were Muslim but preferred a more liberal expression of their faith. This has changed over the years, and there are some Malaysian women who have been trying to push for reform. To what extent can they rely on your court for assistance, or is it entirely in the hands of the religious court?
It's entirely in the hands of the religious courts. But although hijab is the head covering, you will find a lot of Muslim women who don't... It's not a legal requirement. It's a religious requirement. So you want to... You comply with the religion. The court doesn't have any jurisdiction to punish you because you don't have a headgear on for the Muslims in Malaysia. And very, very few. If you see those with the covered face, the likelihood they are Arab visitors in black ground with that, they are most likely that, because even the Malay Muslims in Malaysia, maybe a very small, very, 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 very small number cover the head, face completely. Otherwise, you are, I have two nieces, twins. One decided to cover the head, the other does not cover the head, but together. They have their own practices, you know.
As my wife pointed out on one occasion, it does away with the bad hair day.
Yeah, that's the advantage. You don't have to go to the hairdressers.
Any further questions? Here's one right down here.
Damaris Moura from Brazil. Recently, where I operate, I'm the president, chairman of the commission for the freedom of religion from the Bar Association of Brazil. And recently, we had a case in one of our jails, of women's jails in São Paulo, where there were six women, Muslim women, in that prison as inmates that were barred from praying, covered for security reasons. This matter was taken to the Commission of Liberty of Religion of the Bar Association of Brazil, and we intervene together with the prison, and from that we resulted in a negotiation so that the women could wear the veil within the times of their prayers. So now I ask, this matter for the Attorneys Association of Brazil was very, very meaningful, and this intervention was to secure the democracy, the plain democracy that we live in the country of Brazil, and the protection to the freedom of religion to the foreigners. Now I ask, the use of the veil, the head veil, is it absolutely necessary to profess, to manifest the Muslim religion, or could they do their prayers without wearing the veil, and this would not hurt their religious tradition? Thank you very much.
As far as I'm concerned, I'm not expert in the religion, but our practice is, in order for the woman to pray, she must cover all the hair, not even one piece of hair. The face can be shown, the hand up to this, and only the feet. Every other part must be covered for the purpose of prayer. That is the requirement. Otherwise, the prayer is not accepted. It's not a prayer for the women. For the men, you must cover from the navel right down to the knee for the men, minimum coverage. But of course, we dress more than that nowadays. You know. But the minimum is from the knee, from the navel to the knee, below the knee. But the women, Muslim, must be covered. In fact, they cannot have their face covered when they're praying. They have to take the face, the covering out when they're there. The face. They cover the knee, but they cannot have the whatever you call it. You cannot do that. Okay? Thank you.
Does that finish the questions? One more over here.
Yes, no, yes. I was afraid of speaking because I'm a politician, so I might make some harm to the audience. But the underlying subject that has been spoken mainly in the Malaysia case is related to what is the position of the state towards religion. I don't want to speak about the Malaysian case, but broadly speaking, whenever a state adopts a religion in current societies, I think one is undermining pluralism, is limiting the freedom of association, of expression, of opinion, at the end, the freedom of conscience. And those are basic figures for any democracy or for any country that
is committed to human rights. So I would say that this tremendous challenge in achieving a state that can be ruled by law and can be considered a democracy. Otherwise, we will end in some kind of state. We will admit states which do not adhere to the basic international standards that are set up by international organizations, which represent a consensus of all over the world. And this is not only serious about that, but it's serious about religion. Because in some way, it is limiting the possibilities of other religions to express. I'm a senator from Chile. And our story in these two centuries of existence, of independent existence, is the story of a state that was a confessional state, a Catholic state, but today is a secular state. We admit all kinds of religions. And more than that, the status of all religions, not only Catholic Church, of which I'm a member, is that they're all equals under the law. There's not only freedom of religion, but also equality of legal status. And the legal status is not of the private nature, but of a public nature. Because religion, in my view, is a necessary expression for humankind. And to limit it, or to think that the only religion that can have chance to express is our own religion, is really impeding the common good and the purposes of any person that wants to perfection itself in life. So it's not only a question of how can we articulate the relations among the different creeds. It's also the way one society needs to further to support strongly the chances for humanity to develop in each society. And I would make a, I'm sorry if I'm extending too much, but I won't be able to speak tomorrow in the plenary as it was planned, so I'm taking profit less, like politicians do. And I'd like to make an additional comment that is not directly related to this discussion, but one of the threats that we are seeing nowadays is not only the limitations or restrictions to freedom of religion, of which we're speaking now, in the sense that there's a dominant religion or that we're trying to give privileges to one. How can we make it possible that everybody can have its own religion and non-believers as well be respected, not only tolerated? It's not only a question of tolerance. Tolerance is, in my view, something a little arrogant. I tolerate you. No, it's a question of respect. It's a human respect that we owe each other, whether we believe or whether we don't believe, whether you share our religion or whether you don't share our religion. But what's going on is something that is giving a step ahead as we speak. We can see that to different reasons. Several of them have been analyzed in this morning discussion and recently. For instance, the way Muslim women dress in European countries, which has raised some issues. But the underlying issues is immigration in Europe. Or the way some people that profess a religion, for instance, Muslims, are seen as some enemy because of what happened in 9/11, which is not a question of a religion, but still someone abuses of the fact in order to develop another interest that they have. What I'm trying to say is that we have to consider the need of religion in a world that, for one reason or another, is trying to get rid, probably, of religions, or trying to put religions back in the closet, back in the private sphere, because they are interfering in public decisions. And so it's not only a question of admitting freedom of religion. It's not only a question of democracy and human rights, which it is. It's not only a need to support religions as a necessary expression of humankind. It's also a need to unite different religions to defend their status, because what is probably coming in the near future is not a question of this religion or this other religion, but probably of beliefs in itself. Thank you.
Firstly, I think the country should follow what the majority of the population would like. As I said to you just now, even this morning, somebody spoke about China. The Chinese in China are quite happy with the law there. The Saudis in Saudi Arabia is quite happy. And the Saudi Arabia is quite happy not to allow non-Muslims to go into certain area in Mecca. That is what the people want. You are talking about the idealism, where the whole world is of one religion or one practice, but it will never happen. It can never happen. We see that. We try to make the best of what we can within the circumstances. Malaysia has 60% Muslims and 40% non-Muslim. We respect each other. I use the word respect, not just tolerate. We respect each other. You go and pray the way you want. I pray the way I want. And as I said just now, I visit, a Hindu friend visit me. I make sure that I don't serve beef. It's all respect. And when I go to his house, he makes sure that he doesn't serve pork on me. That is all respect. But what you want is the ideal situation will never arise, not in this the way I foresee today. Next, for even in this hall, so many of us are believing differently. We are trying to understand each other. That's why we are here to discuss. But I don't think we could ever achieve what, if I understand you correctly, what you want. That is the idealism. I don't know.
If I could just comment briefly, I've been reflecting today on the realities of the political world, because that's the world you come from, and it's the world that governs, in the end, what happens to all of us, subject to the next election, of course. It can be a very difficult political balance, and I think that's why some of the Pacific Island nations have these very ambivalent constitutional provisions, because on the one hand, they understand that they must attempt at least to apply the international rights that are recognised by international organisations. On the other hand, they don't want to have something that's very divisive and unsettling in their community, and so politicians don't want that either. And that is why I think we get these compromises with the terms of constitutions that protect religious freedoms and other matters too. But on the other hand, the whole point of having international norms is that minorities are protected. And you can't just have international norms for what the majority want. Their whole rationale is to protect the minorities and to respect whatever it is, whether it's they're men or women, or what colour they are, what race they are, what religion they are. And so there is that balance, but it's, I understand from a political point of view, it's the art of the possible. But I was slightly concerned by the speaker this morning who spoke about the European Court of Human Rights and how the international norms have to be interpreted in their national context. I fully accept that any particular case must be considered in its own factual context, But if, for example, you decide that crucifixes are okay in schools in Italy because most people agree with that in Italy, what's going to happen when the same issue arises in a country where only the minority support that particular outcome? And it does seem to me there's a real risk of watering down the international norms if we're going to allow exceptions depending on which country we're talking about. So these are extremely difficult issues, and I know the courts stand ready, Cliff, to answer these questions, but I think we're all rather hoping they don't actually come to us because they are very, very difficult questions, and often they depend not so much on the usual legal principles that we apply every day to the facts of cases, but to values that are inevitably a moving feast depending on who's looking at them.
Well, that's why I have these two bright people here. I don't have to make any decisions or break any ties. It's quite a luxury. What have we learned today during our time together? I think one thing that we've learned is that it's very careful. We have to carefully use the word pluralism. In my country, 30 years ago, it was 40 years ago, it was called the melting pot. And the melting pot meant that when people came to the United States, they became an American and we blended together. That's not pluralism today, at least in most countries. What we have is various groups coming to countries. As Chief Justice Zaki pointed out, that in Malaysia, people maintain their culture, that they bring it with them, and they have a separate type of life. And so it is in the United States. Too often, we don't refer to ourselves as Americans, but we hyphenate ourselves with another culture. We become Mexican-Americans or Scottish-Americans or whatever. And so pluralism will have a much different effect, in my judgment, depending upon whether that pluralism is a melting pot or whether it's a series of cultures where we become hyphenated. And then the difficulty is exacerbated by religion. It isn't helped by religion. It's exacerbated because when you're a melting pot, you look for compromises to live together. When you're hyphenated, you want only your way. And so as this grows, it's going to have, it seems to me, an effect upon religion which may be different in different cultures. But what we do know is that it will continue to increase as population grows, as the ability to move grows, and hopefully as we decrease the problems that we have in the world of those who would settle things by taking lives so that it's safe to make movements, there will be more movements and more difficulties and challenges that we have in pluralism as pluralism itself changes and calls upon us for new answers. So we might want to put down for 10 years from now religious freedom in a pluralistic age, trends, challenges, and practices, part two. In the meantime, I assure you, the courts will do all they're able to do to help it along the way. But we all must be aware that the courts have limitations upon what they can do. It's really a problem for people. It's an understanding that can only come as we as leaders can bring people together to divide the lines, to bring the melting pot back. Then we'll make real progress in granting religious freedom to all the people, which should be and hopefully is our goal. Thanks for being with us. Our next session will start in 15 minutes, and thanks for your attendance. Would you please give a round of applause to my two colleagues? Well done.